Hello, and welcome back to Current Account. I'm your host, Clay Lowry, the Executive Vice President here at the Institute of International Finance. On Current Account, I try to talk about what I see as the most important current issues in international finance and economics, while providing a U.S. political and policy angle on these different issues when it is relevant. On this week's Current Account, we are talking to the IIF CEO and President, Tim Adams. The last time Tim was on the podcast was at the end of 2023 to wrap up the year and give his thoughts on some major themes for 2024. Today, we're going to talk about the spring meetings week here in Washington, D.C. As quick background, what is the spring meetings week? It's when the IMF, the World Bank, the G20, and others, including the Financial Stability Board, they come together and they meet in Washington, D.C. So central bank governors, finance ministers, and key regulators throughout the world come to Washington for a few days of discussions. Maybe they can move forward on some issues and try to figure out what's going on in the global economy and global financial markets, and try to figure out how to make things as stable as possible and hopefully better economic growth. That's what the objectives are. That doesn't mean that it always works. And so that's what we're going to talk to Tim a little bit about. So, Tim, welcome back. First of all, how do you see the spring meetings developing? You've done this for many, many years. Is there anything different this spring meeting than you've seen in the past?
Yeah, great. Clay, thank you. It's always great to be back. And you've got a great show here. And thank you for making me a part of it. You know, you and I have been around these annual and spring meetings for more decades than I care to reveal. They have traditionally in the spring been a bit sleepy, very relaxed. It was actually an opportunity to actually do deeper dives with fewer people, and I would find them, you know, fairly productive. This year is different and surprisingly different. I wouldn't have said this 4 or 5 months ago. In fact, we didn't really plan for it. We've been scrambling a bit to get ready for something much more muscular, much more robust. And I see it with other institutions, organizations around town. And I think a lot of this is driven by certainly the request I've received from my travels over the last few months is to focus on geopolitical risk, because there's enormous concern among our client base and among policymakers that we are at some sort of historical inflection point. And there's a multitude of analogies, historical analogies, which I won't go into. So we have been here at the IIF putting together a thorough and robust program for the upcoming meetings, in addition to the standard set of issues: where is growth, how do we think about central bank digital currencies, private credit and NBFI, artificial intelligence, cybersecurity, all the things that are normally in our wheelhouse that we do on a daily basis. This year, we've tried to also bring in geopolitical implications and analysis and a variety of different speakers to help us and our member firms think more broadly and maybe more historically.
Okay, so let's maybe go into a couple of those issues. Let's first, since you mentioned and said it's possible of an historical inflection point, let's think about geopolitical risk. And I know we talked about that at the end of 2023. There was a lot of elections that are taking place in 2024. Some of them have already happened. We obviously have some big ones still to come, such as the United States, the United Kingdom, Mexico. India is actually just starting very soon. It's a election that takes a little while. It's not just a one-day election. But that's just kind of scratching the surface in some respects. There are other geopolitical risks out there. Maybe how are they affecting economics and finance? Where we just heard IMF Managing Director Kristalina Georgieva give a sobering speech where she basically said we're going to have tepid economic growth. And she is very concerned about some of the things that you're talking about, some of the trends that she's seeing. So maybe you can kind of go a little more in depth there.
Sure. Well, I think there's an economic layer. You know, we had many decades of rapid global growth and globalization and integration. And, you know, there were complaints about aspects of that phenomenon and that era. And some of those criticisms are legitimate. But it seemed like a bit of a golden era now in retrospect. And I think what she emphasized, or at least illuminated, is greater fragmentation, protectionism, isolationism. And how might that evolve in a way that goes from just economic inefficiencies to something closer to kinetic conflict. I do remind you, and you know this because we talk about it daily, we do have a war on Europe's eastern periphery, one that's still on a daily basis, and we just seen in the last 24 hours continues without pause. We have war in the Levant, which by some estimates could expand over the coming days and weeks. And Asia Pacific always feels a bit tense. So there's much to worry about. I tend to be an optimist. There are a lot of people who catastrophize and talk about cataclysmic outcomes. I think it's like the old Reagan statement, trust but verify. I think you hope for the best, but I think boardrooms around the world, whether it's the financial sector or the real economy, are preparing for a variety of different scenarios. And some of those scenarios could be quite harrowing.
Okay. So let me talk about one scenario and its interaction with the United States. Our relationship with China has deteriorated over the years, the United States relationship, I should say. And we have two presidential campaigns, former President Trump and current President Biden, and they're fighting it out on a lot of issues, of course, and a lot of different subjects. How do you see the relationship with China and the United States developing as we go forward? Or is it one of those things where it's kind of negative and it's going to stay a bit negative, but it gets put on a little bit of hold during an election season here in the United States? I don't know. How do you see that?
Yeah, I think irrespective of who's elected and how the how these campaigns run from now to November 5th, China is on the ballot. And irrespective of the winner of November 5th's election, I think China is going to be a top foreign policy and economic policy concern and target, and one that can certainly be managed. And those of us who've spent our lives looking for solutions and ways to manage relationships and look for where we have a shared interest. And we certainly, the U.S. and China has a shared interest, and Europe and China has a shared interest across a whole range of topics, including environmental issues. Those of us who would hope that we can manage through this, I must say, there's concern that that might not be the base case scenario. This town feels like it's girding for confrontation, both from the left and the right. And with good leadership, we can work our way through it. I think Secretary Yellen's recent trip is a step in attempting to manage that relationship, which is similar to previous Treasury Secretaries, which you and I have worked for over the past decades, looking for ways to manage that relationship. And Secretary Yellen's not the only one. Secretary Raimondo and Secretary Blinken and others have, and the president himself has engaged with President Xi Jinping. I think they're all looking for ways to manage this relationship and try to have a mature and a thoughtful approach to common problems and common solutions. But I'll tell you, it just feels like there's a movement in this town for greater conflict and greater confrontation. I don't know where that takes us, and I don't know how we stand back from it, but it makes me very concerned.
Okay, so let's move from the big picture and the big concerns to maybe the, I guess it's probably not fair to call it the mundane because it's extremely important, but the things that we do try to focus on a lot. Where do you see economic growth going? We keep hearing inflation is finally coming back down, but it actually seems like it kind of has a little more, it's hanging around a little bit more. That's kind of one set of issues. Then there's all different ones, and you mentioned a bunch of them in your opening, which is, how do we think about digital currencies? How do we think about artificial intelligence? There will be a lot of discussion, I'm sure, about the Basel III endgame, which is basically about prudential regulation. And I'm sure a few other issues that I just forgot, but maybe two parts to give you a break. One would be sort of an economic kind of dynamism from the world and the issue of inflation. And then second is maybe some of these kind of more specific issues as we go into the system.
Sure. Well, the U.S. economy's outperformed forecast that we saw last October when we were in Marrakesh for the annual meetings. The U.S. economy especially has outperformed the base case scenario that we would have a recession. And last year we talked about the reluctant recession. Now we talk about the non-existent recession. We have an economy that's growing above potential. We have incredibly tight labor markets. We have financial conditions that are loose. We are running historically large fiscal deficits of 6%, which seems a bit sobering given that we're at the top of the cycle. It may be irresponsible given that we're at the top of the cycle. And we have, you know, and as part of that deficit, we are, you know, large spending programs, the CHIPS Act and the IRA and a whole range of other things that may certainly be necessary to continue to build the industrial base of the United States. I don't necessarily buy into that it was hollowed out, but that's for a different discussion. So there's an enormous amount of demand. We have a shortage of labor, especially legal immigration. And so you have an economy that's running hot. Consumers continue to defy gravity, despite the fact we see an increase in credit card delinquencies. Consumers are spending. And all this has far exceeded what the professional forecasting thought would occur. So the U.S. is, along with probably better than expected Chinese growth trajectory, is pulling the rest of the world along. And I think probably the worst is behind us for Europe. And that too can be an important element of growth going forward. But that's on a cyclical basis. On a structural basis, we're not where we used to be. And the question is, why is productivity weaker today than it was 30 or 40 or 50 years ago? And why do we not have the kind of growth that we saw in, you know, this magical period of the 50s and 60s and up to really early 70s when things began to shift? And we don't know. But to deal with the demographic challenges that we have in the advanced economies, the level of debt that is occurring, our next debt monitor will be out in a few weeks. We're at historic levels of debt, household, corporate, sovereign, sub-sovereign, you name it, which means we pulled growth forward. We need to find new growth models. We need to focus on productivity. We need to focus on labor force participation and immigration, legal immigration. And we need to do it quickly. You know, there's huge debate about the role of industrial policy, and that would be a solution. You know, I don't know. I'm a bit of a skeptic, but, you know, that's for experts to debate what that looks like. Because the left says, you know, we have one set of industrial policy. The right says, no, that's the wrong industrial policy. We have a different industrial policy. I think the key is to create an enabling environment for private capital formation and let entrepreneurs do what they do and businesses start and grow and flourish. So we need faster economic growth, and we need to focus on growth around the world. And we especially need to do it in the advanced economies. And that seems to be one of the challenges beyond just the cyclical components. But the U.S. economy is hot. Inflation is sticky. It's going to be sticky. And I think central banks are going to be challenged to get back to what we once thought was price stability, or price stability as it was defined and it was prevailing during the last 20 years.
Okay, so I'm going to pick up on that theme. I thought it was a really good point about economic growth and the importance of it. And let's kind of go down towards the financial services firms that we work with, banks, insurance companies, asset managers, et cetera. Obviously, they're really important for economic growth because of the nature of the work that they do. Now, they're trying to figure out what are the opportunities out there. And some of them are like artificial intelligence. That seems like it could be a great opportunity. Investing in sustainable finance in a way that actually makes sense. But then, of course, at the same time, they have to look at the challenges or the risks that come up. Risks of cyber issues, risks of the regulatory environment, this Basel III endgame stuff, risks of sustainable finance regulatory burden. How is that kind of gelling together? And do you see anything happening next week in this area, or probably going forward? I mean, 1 week doesn't solve anything. So,
oh, Clay, there's a lot to unpack there. So I'll start with, you know, one quip I always like to make, which is capitalism without capital is just another ism. And capital and capital formation is the key. And it's about getting, you know, household savings channeled into the hands of investors, into business people, into entrepreneurs, so that you can start and grow the private sector. That's the future. And the public sector plays an enormously important role in ensuring that that capital flows and that allocations is done in an efficient and hopefully seamless way as possible, while securing investor protection and household protection. The key is, broadly, how do you put in place an enabling environment, which is how do you keep interest rates low and regulation at a reasonable level, and you know, the value of the currency, and, you know, vibrant transportation systems and human capital. And I was just seeing an article this morning about a major shipbuilder that was having trouble hiring sufficient number of workers with the right technical skills. There are something like 8 million unfilled positions in the United States, including key professions like welders and plumbers and electricians. And my father was a union welder, so I know what that looks like. You can't build the 21st century economy without computer programmers, and you can't build it without plumbers and electricians and welders. And we just need more trained technical workers, and we just don't have enough. So that's all of these components go into the soup of creating an environment for economic growth. AI, there's been more written about AI and productivity than would fill this office building. I tend to be an optimist. I think it will be an enabler. I think it's more assisted intelligence rather than artificial intelligence. I think it will make us all more productive. Will it mean shifts in the workforce? Absolutely. But that's been the nature of life for the last 100 years, as we went from the farms to the factories to, into the service industry and the knowledge workers. This is just another stage of human and intellectual capital development. And I think it's an enormous enabler. It will also mean displacement. But we just need to make sure we have policies to help those that are displaced and make sure that we're appropriately prepared for, what this transition looks like. So I'm an optimist over time. I just hope the public sector can get it right by putting in place the right enabling environment and just letting entrepreneurs do what they do, right? Let the tech sector and boring businesses, the people who start restaurants or run garages or start car dealerships, that's the beauty of the country, is the millions of small and medium-sized businesses that flourish every day that don't get on the front pages of the Wall Street Journal, but are incredibly important to how this economy functions.
Thank you, Tim. That was great. I have two more questions for you, and then I'll get you out of here because you got a lot of work to do for next week. First, I'm going to put my cynicism out there, which is the IMF World Bank meetings and G20 and all that is great. And people need to come together and have these conversations and think through these issues. But a lot of times we do look to see whether any action will take place. And I try to kind of be cynical about that. I don't mean to be, but I kind of am. Do you see anything being accomplished next week? Any deliverables, I guess, is the right word. Or should I just go with my cynicism and say, that's not really the point? So anyway.
Yeah, I think the big deliverable is elevating and illuminating what are the key challenges and possible solutions for political decision makers, for parliaments and legislatures and prime ministers and presidents who aren't necessarily here. These are the technicians, the experts, and I know we're in an era where experts are not seen with great affection, but it's an opportunity to stress test everyone's base case scenario, including the bank and the funds and our own, and better understand how we might get it wrong. Look at various risk scenarios and think about how we might plan for that. Look for possible solutions, contest of ideas, if you will. I go back to industrial policy. Does it work? Doesn't it work? If it works, what are the circumstances? What is history? What are other examples around the world tell us about how it works? The academic community has become infatuated with industrial policy over the last year or two. So what do we learn? What is the evidence from other countries? So I think it's a cauldron of ideas and expertise. And out of that, I think we can derive some takeaways by which policymakers and political actors can have important inputs. Now, whether they utilize those inputs or not is a different story. But I do think it does play an important role.
I love the phrase cauldron of ideas. So I'll be a little more on the positive side, which is, all right, we are going to be hosting a lot of conversations. Some of them are going to be very detailed on specific issues. Some of them are going to be a broader sense. Who are you looking forward to listening to and talking to?
Oh, because we got a great week planned. We have a vibrant public agenda. And then we've got, a number of small roundtable conversations with some of our board and member firms and with a lot of different experts, historians, academics, and policymakers on the public stage. We got Andrew Bailey coming back. And I'm a big fan of Andrew. He always likes to make news here in our stage. But I think he's very thoughtful, and I've known him for a long time. We got Pablo DaCosta coming, and it's his role as the chairman of the Basel Committee. He's going to give a speech on artificial intelligence. My good friend Raghu Rajan's coming from the University of Chicago, used to be head of the Reserve Bank of India, and at the IMF. And the person back in 2005, 2006 that was writing about his concerns about U.S. Housing and as a potential risk going forward. We have Vali Nasser here, who is at Johns Hopkins University, one of the leading experts on Iran and the Middle East. And given what's going on in the Levant and the broader Middle East, I think his insights will be incredibly important to hear. So Mickey Bowman, the governor of the Federal Reserve Board, will be here. Senator Hagerty, a very thoughtful, our former U.S. ambassador to Japan. In fact, we used to, whenever we'd go to Tokyo, we'd always spend some time with him. Very thoughtful person. So it's a broad range of policymakers, economists, historians. I think it's going to be a great week. I hope people show up with an empty notebook because you're going to fill it. You know, it's going to be full by the time next Saturday rolls around.
Tim, thank you very much. Looking forward to this week. And thanks again for coming on.
Fabulous. Thank you for having me.
And now it's time for my 3-2-1. That's my three main takeaways for my conversation with the president and CEO of IIF, Tim Adams. Two things I'm looking forward to, and my one sports fact. So the three main takeaways I got were, first, are we going into an historical inflection point as we go into this week's IMF World Bank G20 meetings, largely driven by geopolitical risk that has led towards greater protectionism, that has led towards more isolation and more balkanization, and is leading towards potentially more inefficiencies in economic markets? Second, where does the U.S.-China relationship, or how does it develop, especially given that we are in a political season? And third, there's a lot of important issues around economic growth and inflation, but also around things like digital assets, artificial intelligence, debt issues, private credit, and sustainable finance. Obviously, that's a lot of issues. The two things I'm looking forward to. The first is this week's spring meetings from the IMF, World Bank, and G20 itself. I love Tim's phrase. It's a way to have a cauldron of ideas and people with different ideas from different parts of the world to try to address some of the issues I just mentioned. And the second, I'm looking forward to actually all the different events that the IIF is going to be hosting. Tim mentioned a number of very high-level officials that will be having conversations. But we have real good expertise that is coming on areas as diverse as what's happening in the Mexican economy, what's happening in the sovereign debt issues, and what's happening on cybersecurity. And that's just scratching the surface. And so now let me get to my one sports fact. So my favorite time of the year is over, which is college basketball and the college basketball tournaments. And we got to see dominant performance in the men's NCAA by the University of Connecticut, and the first back-to-back champion we've seen in 15 years. But we also saw a dominant performance on the women's side by South Carolina, which came out on top for the second time in 3 years. And maybe more importantly, they were undefeated as they went through the whole system. At the same time, we got to see the amazing individual accomplishments of people like Caitlin Clark from Iowa and Zach Edey from Purdue, who both lost in the finals, but had amazing individual seasons and college careers. But I thought more importantly and more interestingly was the rise of women's sports. I've talked about this a little bit on this podcast, but the South Carolina-Iowa championship game, which was the women's final, drew a record 18.7 million viewers, with peak viewership coming at 24 million. Now, those numbers don't mean that much until you put them in context. One of the largest viewing for any sports event in the United States outside of probably the Super Bowl. And it surpassed, for the first time ever, the men's finals, where they drew roughly 15 million on average, with 19 million peak viewers. But this goes towards a bigger trend of the rise of women's sports in the viewership and the passion that's involved. So there's always been passion, but now it's a passion that's broadening out. We saw that last year in the U.S. women's tennis finals at the U.S. Open, where Coco Gauff and Aryna Sabalenka fought it out in front of 3.5 million viewers. The Women's World Cup garnered over 2 billion viewers across the world throughout its series last year. And just two individual events, women's volleyball in Nebraska got over 90,000 people to come to the game. And Barcelona played Wolfsburg in Spain in the Champions League Cup for women, and they also drew over 90,000 people to the game. Anyway, I think it's very exciting as a dad with two daughters to see women's sports rise up and surpass in many ways men's sports. Well, that's going to wrap up this episode of Current Account. I again want to thank Tim Adams for his appearance on the show today. He's always entertaining. And as always, we'd love to hear your feedback on the show as we constantly look to improve and enhance the experience for you, the listener. We can be reached at podcast@iif.com. All our episodes can be found on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts from. Thanks for listening, and goodbye.